Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Mecklenburg's COVID-19 infection numbers are moving in the right direction, but health officials warn about becoming complacent. After all, look at what happened at UNC Chapel Hill. They opened and closed in days as COVID clusters appeared. Other schools are struggling with that, too. The first week of public school has been plagued by technical glitches statewide. And as the Democrats wrap up the first virtual convention ever, the Republicans prepare for theirs. And Charlotte will host a one-day or a half-day gathering here on Monday. And here to talk about those stories and more is Steve Harrison, WFAE's political reporter. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
Katie Peralta is here. She's senior editor for the Charlotte Agenda. Thank you for being here.
Morning.
Jonathan Lowe is anchor reporter for Spectrum News One. Hello again.
Great to be with you, Mike.
And Katie Ma is back. She is the education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Welcome to you, Katie. Annie, I'm sorry.
Morning, Mike.
So let's start with an update on the coronavirus situation. This week, Governor Roy Cooper said most of North Carolina's indicators are remaining stable and that some are declining.
While we're encouraged by the numbers, just remember, this is because many North Carolinians are doing the right things, taking the right precautions, and making good decisions. Those who are making good decisions to fight the spread of the virus have to continue. Those who aren't need to start.
So the number of cases has been falling for a month, but new cases are presenting themselves. Is this because social distancing is working, more people are wearing masks, or is something else at work here?
It appears that, go ahead, ladies first.
Katie. I was going to say maybe a little bit of all the above. I think that they have said people are masking up, as they say, a lot more often in public places, as is required now. You can hardly go into any store or public place without seeing people with masks on. There's certainly a lot of social distancing going on, again, as required. But I think also, you know, there's a understanding that this thing is not getting any better unless we all take it very seriously. And that's certainly a message that they've been trying to hammer home.
Is the political pushback diminishing at all in this, Jonathan?
I would say so, just to add to the great point that Katie brought up, in that I remember earlier when we, you know, first time that we stayed in phase two here in North Carolina, there was a lot of outcry. I remember we had, that was at the height of the Reopen NC campaign. And I was just thinking to myself the other day, we really haven't heard much from them. And that I believe that has a lot to do with this spike that has happened here now in the summer. Remember earlier this summer, late spring, health officials were thinking possibly that there would be, that maybe the virus would abate for a little, and then that there may be a later second spike in the fall. But as we've seen, you know, how intense a resurgence can be when you don't have certain requirements in place. I think a lot of businesses have responded to that. Even the pushback on businesses enforcing masks, just, you know, an unofficial survey looking around at a lot of businesses now, Mike, have signs up saying you cannot enter without wearing a mask. So here in North Carolina, I think we have, it has benefited us that we have stayed in phase two, and we're seeing that in the numbers.
In Mecklenburg County, there were 154 new cases as of Tuesday. We're adding about 165 cases on average a day, but that too is a downward trend, and County Health Director Gibby Harris called that incredibly good news. But
we are at a little bit of a precarious state here, where we have the ability to go in the right direction where we're headed, or we have the particular, you know, if people believe that it's opportunity now to open wide up again, we could go in the other direction. So we have to watch that carefully.
In other words, there's no room for complacency. 266 people in Mecklenburg County alone have now died from COVID-19, and we're just a few weeks away from the scheduled end of phase two restrictions. Have officials given any indication of what the governor's thinking or Mandy Cohen, the state health director, is thinking about moving on September 11th to phase three? Any indications at all?
I know, or just it's 276 deaths, Mike.
Okay.
And I know that Annie's going to get into the weeds of what's happened with schools. But if you look at, you know, how the positivity rates on college campuses, and I know we're going to talk about UNC in a little bit, if you look at how those positivity rates have increased, and also what's happening with schools that are having in-person learning, I would be betting that the governor is looking at that, and the Secretary of Health are both looking at that as, you know, kind of this may keep us in phase two. I wouldn't be surprised.
But I think I was going to say that kind of piggybacking on what Jonathan said, you know, I think that there's room. You could argue there's room for kind of a hybrid phase two. Museums are still closed. I mean, museums are one of the most socially distant activities that we have, right? I mean, there's never a huge rush of people at an art museum, or, you know, there are things, you know, outdoor playgrounds. So I think there's some room to open up more and not necessarily open the floodgates. I mean, the big one is going to be bars. And will bars ever open?
Mm-hmm. And then there's also gyms.
I mean, gym owners have been really pushing to reopen ever since. I think we were thinking that we would enter the next phase in like June. So it's been quite a while, and they're hurting a lot. And you've seen, you know, a lot of gym owners either opening technically illegally, or, you know, getting creative with how they continue operations, such as hosting classes outside. But as Steve said, there certainly is a little bit of room for maybe a modified reopening, as opposed to, you know, over Memorial Day or whenever that was, when we entered phase two, it seemed as if floodgates opened. You know, reopening didn't mean reopen everything.
And
4th of July. Thank you. That's right.
A better understanding of like what the risk spectrum looks like. And I think a lot of these like things that were written, like this will open in phase one, phase two, mm-hmm. like were written when we didn't have that understanding. It makes more sense to kind of reevaluate that right now.
And I think a lot of that understanding and a lot of people coming to grips with this is coming from what they're seeing as schools go back into session. And we'll talk about that in a second. But Wake Forest Baptist Health is now recruiting, quote, healthy adults for a phase three clinical research study to evaluate the safety and effectiveness of a vaccine candidate against COVID-19. This is sponsored by the drug company Moderna, and they are seeking, quote, healthy volunteers 18 and older in high-risk populations, including the elderly and racial and ethnic minorities at higher risk for COVID-19. Does that mean that those people who volunteer for this will be putting themselves at risk for this, and do we know if they've successfully recruited anybody from those high risk categories?
I was just going to say, Mike, that I was reading earlier this week that to your very point that there is a lot of not fear but skepticism about this vaccine, and a lot of people thinking that this is being rushed and are second guessing the efficacy of a vaccine. So these efforts are having issues getting people to volunteer. And I think that this particular trial that you're talking about, they're looking for 30,000 people across the nation.
Wow.
I think they're still having issues getting people to come forward.
30,000 people in a study that is scheduled to go for 25 months. That's over 2 years. So is that how far away we are from a vaccine? Let's hope not. I mentioned last week that the health director of Orange County had pleaded with the chancellor of UNC Chapel Hill not to bring students back on campus, to no avail. The university opened, students arrived, and almost immediately the decision was made to cancel in-person teaching and send students home after a rapid breakout of COVID clusters.
I'm disappointed for so many of our students who were adhering to our community standards and who really want to be here. And I'm looking forward to a time when we can move past this and return to a normal campus experience for everyone.
That's UNC Chapel Hill Chancellor Kevin Giskowitz speaking with WRAL in Raleigh. There's been a lot of criticism of the university's Board of Governors for pushing for complete reopening. It's a board that has experienced turnover in the last several years as the Republican legislature has been moving Republican partisans into those positions. And Republicans, led by the president, have been pushing to reopen things and get things back to normal. So can we assume that this decision to reopen the university was politically motivated, or did the chancellor make the decision to open based on the economics of bringing students back to campus?
Well, I think all of those are possible. In addition to, the Board of Governors doesn't just represent UNC Chapel Hill, right? It represents a number of campuses.
Schools. Yeah.
So one thing that I read is that the decision that was made and how they came to the decision was not just for Chapel Hill. It was for other schools. Like, for instance, North Carolina A&T, we at Spectrum News One, we just spoke with them late last week going into the weekend, I believe, where the vice chancellor was saying that they are having in-person classes and online classes, but they're not seeing any clusters so far. I don't know if it's the way that they're handling things, how many students they have per class, how they've controlled these off-campus parties, because that's been a big part of this and the clusters that we've seen. But the Board of Governors, you know, playing devil's advocate to answer your question, they will say that it's because the decision was not just for Chapel Hill, but for a variety of different campuses.
Well, for students, it must have felt like whiplash as they literally moved in and then almost immediately had to pack up and move out. But at least one student, Anna Snyder, told WRAL that she wasn't really angry at anybody.
It's really sad, and I wish it were different, but I'm not going to, like, pretend like I know more than all the people who study this and it's their job to make this decision.
There were reports of lax social distancing at student gatherings at Chapel Hill and people not wearing masks. Are we to assume that this is where these COVID cases came from, Annie? Do we have any indication of that?
I think it'll be hard to figure that out. I will say the first couple of clusters were not at frat houses or anything. They were just in student living quarters. And you can imagine just the nature of those with like shared bathrooms and shared spaces. It would be hard to not come into close contact with people. I don't know that we have the answer yet to the extent that like social distancing affected this.
I will say, to add to that, as far as NC State, their first few cases were at sorority and fraternity houses. Right. And we had video over the weekend from some of those off-campus parties where, I mean, it was a party, no masks, no social distancing. So while in one case at UNC, it looks like they were in dorms for the most part, the clusters at NC State were, they came out of the sorority and fraternity houses that apparently were having these off-campus gatherings.
And of course, these kids, I think they were screened as they arrived on campus, weren't they? Weren't their temperatures taken and questionnaires given out about have you been around people with COVID and all the things that you would go through if you went to any doctor's office? I think they did that. If they didn't, let me know. But they could still have brought it with them because many people can carry this around and be completely asymptomatic, have no symptoms whatsoever, and then it hits without warning. We're going to talk some more about that, about what happened at UNC Chapel Hill and what's happening around the other campuses in the UNC system when we come back from the break. It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's the Local News Roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and we're here with Steve Harrison, WFAE's political reporter, Annie Ma, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer, Katie Peralta, senior editor for Charlotte Agenda, and Jonathan Lowe, anchor reporter for Spectrum News One. During that first week of school on campus at UNC Chapel Hill, 130 students and five employees tested positive for the coronavirus. That puts the positivity rate on that campus surging from just under 3%, which is what people are comfortable with in the health circles, to nearly 14%, which resulted in hundreds of students being put into isolation and quarantine. The student newspaper up there, the Daily Tar Heel, got national attention for an editorial they ran headlined, UNC has a cluster F on its hands, and they printed the word, which we cannot say here. But speaking with WRAL, the chancellor defended this aborted attempt to have students on campus.
We had all of the, I think, things in place right here within the boundaries of campus to ensure that students were adhering to the community standards, the distancing, the hand hygiene, the wearing of masks. And if you look around campus over these past 2 weeks, that's what you saw. But when things started, activities began to happen off campus and then bring some of that back into the residence halls, that's where we began to see the positive cases. And we were surprised at the velocity and the magnitude of the spread.
Now, health officials had warned that this would happen, and the student newspaper wrote, we all saw this coming. They mentioned that the university had ignored Centers for Disease Control and Prevention guidance that placed the university's housing plan in the highest risk category. How could anyone have been surprised by this?
I think not only University of North Carolina, but other schools around the country, this happened at my alma mater this week, Notre Dame, in fact, school administrators thought that they could control this by giving very detailed guidelines on how to operate on campus, screenings, regulations on how many people could visit your dorm room, things like that. At the end of the day, these are college students. You can't tell them not to party. You can't tell them not to congregate. And as the student newspaper also reported, I believe yesterday, the UNC system president issued a statement essentially blaming the students for the clusters that cropped up. And it's pretty easy to cast blame onto students and a little bit tougher to accept that blame as an administrator, because ultimately it was the administration's decision to open. Schools around the state, including at University of North Carolina in Charlotte, students had been very concerned about reopening. They knew this would happen, sort of like, you know, a lot of people anticipated that we would have a pop over the summer if things reopened too quickly. Again, it's just a little bit inevitable. Yeah. And it's not the kind of thing that you can easily control, because students don't live in a bubble, despite what administrations like to believe.
Mimi Chapman, yeah, who's the chair of the UNC Chapel Hill faculty, told NPR's Mary Louise Kelly on All Things Considered this week that the university has some of the best public health, infectious disease, and health communications people in the country. Quote, if we can't bring those resources to bear in the way that we did with a more successful result, I think it should give every other large public university in the country pause before going forward. Of course, as you mentioned, Katie, Notre Dame has shut their campus and gone online right now, and COVID clusters are popping up at other North Carolina schools. Two NC State sororities were identified on Wednesday as sites of clusters. A cluster is defined as five or more cases in close proximity. And yesterday, with 95 students and two employees testing positive, NC State announced it will move all undergraduate classes online beginning Monday. But students are free to remain on campus in campus housing. Does that make any sense?
I think it's just an inevitability. A lot of students don't have stable internet connections at home. If they're from rural areas, if they don't have broadband service at home, some kids are from not the US and it'd be literally impossible to get them home. I think the way that it's working at Chapel Hill and other universities just across the country as they pivot back and forth, and even in the spring, it's looking at individual situations and trying to, you know, like not send kids to out into the world without a place to be where they can continue their semester.
I thought it was interesting. I think it was WFAE that you guys had brought up earlier this week, the fact that this decision at UNC Chapel Hill came the day before full tuition balances were supposed to be taken care of. Mm-hmm. And apparently the school is, the provost is looking at whether that will be changed. And so that kind of feeds into the question of whether people are skeptical of the quality of online learning, and if that's where they want to put their money. So there's a big question right now with online learning, and is it the same as being in person? And as you know, someone who's taking online classes right now, I find it you know equally as challenging. It's a different sort of engagement, though.
Yeah. Appalachian State has suspended football practice after a cluster of cases, 7 students, 4 staff, all associated with their football program. They report 58 students and employees in isolation as of the second day of class because of COVID-19 up at Appalachian State. What do we know about other campuses in the UNC system, aside from the ones we've talked about? Anything?
I believe East Carolina and UNC Pembroke also have at least 20 cases, I believe, is what I read. Again, I think it's the University of North Carolina and NC State are the ones kind of getting the most attention right now because, and Appalachian, because of these most recent like rapid growth in cases. But again, I do think that this is not unusual. We're going to be hearing more and more campuses around the state and around the country where this is happening as they reopen. Unfortunately, I think UNC Chapel Hill is going to maybe get a lot of heat for this one because they were one of the first ones to publicly reopen and then very publicly close.
And although App State has suspended football practice, they are scheduled to open their season on September the 12th, the day after we're scheduled to go into phase 3. We'll see if that actually happens. But they're scheduled to open their football season September the 12th in Boone against, wait for it, the UNC Charlotte 49ers. What's the situation at UNC Charlotte and with their football team and their student body? What's the situation there?
Well, UNC Charlotte was a little different from the other campuses in that they decided to bring students back later rather than earlier to get the ones who brought them back earlier were trying to get ahead of the holidays. That was not the plan at UNC. When I talked to the chancellor at her first media availability, you know, she said that part of the upside of that was being able to take those few weeks and learn from what's working and what's not working at other campuses. I talked to her before the cluster F at Chapel Hill happened, so I don't know if that thinking has changed, but as far as I've read, I don't know that they've shuttered plans to bring students back.
As cases have mounted around the UNC system, Governor Cooper, Steve, says it's possible he might issue an executive order focused on limiting viral spread. Any idea of what that actually means?
Yeah, that's a good question. I was reading about that and kind of wondering what that means. I mean, what the executive order could do short of shutting down in classroom instruction. So, right, because I'm not really sure what, you know, it seems to be kind of an on or off switch. I would just say one thing that kind of what Annie said about UNC Charlotte waiting a few weeks to see what worked and what didn't. And I think that's an important point because there is value in going back to school. There's value in colleges reopening. And I think that, you know, the Chapel Hill situation shows that the model they had was not working. But I think that there is some value in this dimmer switch we keep talking about with reopening, that you know, let's try and turn the lights on a little more. Mm-hmm. And if it doesn't work, we have to dial it back. So I'm sympathetic to the idea of people trying and to see what works and what doesn't.
And do they have metrics? Like, for instance, the UNC Chapel Hill has shut the doors and they've sent students home and they want to bring them back. Obviously, everybody wants to go back. Do they have metrics for deciding when that time is?
Well, I believe when they were making the decision to have in-person classes, I think they were at like a 3 or 4% positivity rate.
Okay.
And it's skyrocketed now, I believe, 14%
right,
with these clusters. So They are tracking metrics.
So it looks like, Annie,
at least
the public schools, at least in Mecklenburg County, have been a little smarter about this or a little more cautious about this. Perhaps that's the better word, because they made the decision to go online before they even opened. Monday was the first day of school, and it was unlike any other first day we've ever experienced at CMS. How did it go?
I think it really depends on a lot of things. You know, lots of kids are still struggling with internet connectivity issues, getting devices, CMS. You know, this was true when I was in high school. I feel like a lot of school technology is a little clunky and archaic, and there were kids who had to like ask their teachers about how to log on. There was a statewide tech outage. There were all of these things. But I also think, you know, I was at Pop Creek Elementary School and I was able to see a lot of the work that teachers had put in. And it's certainly vastly different from the spring where they kind of just had to do it like today. In terms of remote learning, they've actually had time to build out lessons. They've had time to think about like, how do we do this in a different way? It's not so much like, okay, tomorrow you're online. It's right. What they've been able to be more deliberate about what remote learning looks like. And I've heard from some parents that, you know, given the expectations of all the chaos that was incoming, they actually had a pretty good time and were able to get their kids online, and their kids were much more engaged, much more able to connect with their teachers and students. So it's really a mixed bag, I think, both ends of the spectrum.
Now, I talked to Mark Johnson, who's the state director of public instruction. And he said that over the summer, teachers statewide had been really working on improving how online instruction would work. And what I'm hearing from you is that that is in fact true, and it has made a difference.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think if you just think about it, like if I had to literally do something tomorrow that was as complicated as teaching a class of like 20 kindergartners, it'd be really hard. But like having the whole summer and really having time to like ask myself what online learning looks like, yeah. It really, you know, gives you more time to prepare and think more deliberately about what
so
you
So Katie,
do.
I was going to ask how confident officials are that every child has the equipment that they need and the environment that they need and the online access that they need to learn, but you reported this week that CMS estimates 18,000 students are without internet access. And I know we have a big system. That number sounds big. And in fact, if I did the math correct, and I may not have because I'm not a math genius, that's almost 13% of the entire student population of CMS. What are the implications of that?
So my colleague, Paige Hopkins, reported that story this week, and it was initially thought to be much lower than that, about 8,500. And so it's now believed by CMS that between 16 and 18,000 children do not have internet access, which effectively means they can't learn. Every day that goes by that they can't learn is another day they fall behind. So you know, when we talk about digital divide, this is exactly it. You can give kids laptops and you can equip teachers with knowledge, you know, and understanding how to teach online. But if kids don't have access to something as seemingly basic as internet connection, then all of this is rendered useless because they can't do anything.
And in that same story, she reported that somebody, one student with a Chromebook that's supplied by the system, couldn't log in because either their machine would only type in caps or would not type in caps, and the opposite was needed to log in, so they could not log in. They also wrote, Paige also wrote, parents who don't have internet access or the capacity to keep their child at home sent their students, at least in one case, to the Greer Heights Community Center. I'm just curious how that's different from sending them into a classroom.
I think that might have been from... I might have been in Paige's story, but it was also sounds a lot like the feature okay. that me and Davna right. did. Honestly, the tech thing, my dad does this stuff. Like sometimes you're just like at the whims of the robots. And that sounds like the case with the Chromebook, like that wouldn't let them type in caps. But in terms of the Greer Heights Community Center, I think the thing that like is true of that is like, it's really fixing a need in the community, right? Like even if we had gone back to quote, like in-person learning, there would have been 2 weeks of remote and those kids would have needed somewhere to go. The risk is obviously lower if you're seeing the same individuals every day versus like a rotating cast of students and for teachers. And I think the thing is like if those kids, if these families could keep their children at home, could, you know, like provide them with like internet, if these things were not an issue, like we would not have that community center be open, but it's kind of in need. It's like it's the best choice of out of a slate of bad choices. And I think we're keeping that perspective is really important.
And you mentioned that there were technical glitches, those technical glitches on Monday. And I think it happened again on Wednesday, were statewide technical glitches. And CMS parent Billy Tilly made this comment about that to WBTV.
My youngest, when she got off that first Zoom, she said, well, I guess I'm not going to learn anything today.
So what happened?
So the state, I believe almost every school district uses the same platform from the state. It's called NC EdCloud. And what it is like when you log into Canvas, to PowerSchool, all of these services that the state education system uses, you have to have your identity verified, where you like type in a password and everything. But that service, like on its own, went down on Monday, which meant even if Canvas was working, even if Zoom and PowerSchool were working, you weren't able to get there. Like the doors were closed and locked, and you were completely unable to get on. They fixed it by late morning. I think there were some lingering issues, and every district most districts found a workaround, whether that was directly sending links to student emails or using different platforms to log on. But that's generally the issue with NC EdCloud.
So, Steve, you mentioned before we started today that WCNC TV reported earlier this week that just one day before the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board of Education spent hours debating the plan for the school year, Health Director Gibby Harris fully supported sending some kids back to school for in-person learning. How did she communicate that? To whom did she communicate that? Because I don't believe that was the message she was sending out to the public at large.
Yeah, that's right. This was a really good story that CNC did. They looked at emails that the health director had sent regarding schools, and there was a group email to other health directors in nearby areas. And Gibby Harris said that she supported some kind of in-person learning. She felt it was important for students. And then when there was that mid-July key school board meeting, she really didn't give a position one way or the other. Talked about, well, there are benefits and there are drawbacks. And there are some people at CMS who feel that had she said publicly what she said in the email, that might have switched the vote. I mean, who knows? It's hard to say. But there was a sense that her voice is very important as the county health director.
Well, Union County did go back, and we'll talk about what has happened there as a result of that. We'll also review the DNC, preview the RNC, and talk about some other political things, including the tensions building on Charlotte City Council when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Fifth Third Bank, dedicated to the financial empowerment of the community by investing time, resources, and people in the Charlotte area and throughout the state. More at 53.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, the local news roundup, starring Steve Harrison from WFAE News, Katie Peralta from the Charlotte Agenda, Jonathan Lowe, Spectrum News One, and Annie Ma from the Charlotte Observer. Union County went back to school. They have students in classrooms. And instead of, how did you spend your summer vacation, the questions being asked of returning students were a little different this year.
Have you had any of these symptoms, fevers, chills, shortness of breath or difficulty breathing, new cough, or new loss of taste or smell? Okay. And have you been diagnosed with COVID-19?
Andy, why does Union County feel they can go back when CMS didn't?
You know, I think the there's a lot of nuance there, but the simple answer is politics. The Union County School Board is much more conservative. They have kind of pushed against much of what Governor Cooper and the state have done in terms of their response to COVID. I remember back in the spring, there was pushback from Union County elected leaders, not necessarily the board, but I believe the board supported this, against pass-fail because they thought it would penalize their highest achievers. They wanted to host in-person graduations, and they did over the summer, and there was a cluster, and they've been very, you know, like set on the idea of reopening schools a certain way, even though their school-based employees and their teachers have really pushed back against the idea. There have been numerous drive-by protests, including a pretty iconic one, I believe, on Sunday, where like someone got a like hearse from a pal who had one and drove it past the superintendent's house. So there's a lot of tension brewing there. And I do think that like at the end of the day, a lot of it comes to like different political views of like how they're looking at the facts of reopening.
Well, the Democratic National Convention wrapped up their first ever virtual convention in history in anybody's political party, but not before their highly inventive roll call of states putting candidates' names into nomination featured Cozy Watkins. She is a 68 or 69-year-old, depending upon what news source you read, nurse and Democratic Party activist from Charlotte. And she appeared as part of that roll call in a video clip that went viral.
I've been doing this for a long time, so let me just be plain. Black people, especially black women, are the backbone of this party. And if we don't show up, Democrats don't get elected. I'm putting on my mask, and we're going to every corner in North Carolina to help organize. Because we need to make sure everyone shows up for Joe Biden. He would show up for us. North Carolina cast 39 votes for Bernie Sanders and 83 votes for the next president of the United States, Joe Biden.
First of all, I think everybody agrees that the way they handled that roll call, which could have been deadly and usually is, actually, was miraculously fun to watch. And she was particularly an outstanding person to watch. She was standing out in front of the Hidden Valley neighborhood sign. Normal folks, I guess, took notice of that. So did celebrities. Samantha Bee tweeted, North Carolina is the new host of Full Frontal, which, of course, is her TV show on, I think it's TBS. I don't know what network it's on. Anyway, all the other people in all the other states stood in different locations. She chose the Hidden Valley sign, and I'm wondering if people outside of Charlotte understood the significance of that, Jonathan.
I don't know. You know, if you are a native Charlottean, you certainly know the significance of it. Across the state, maybe people would associate Hidden Valley with some more negative history, Charlotte city history, because it has and still is to this day. There's a lot of crime that happens in that neighborhood, but there's also a lot of history in the Hidden Valley neighborhood. As someone who grew up in East Charlotte, and knew people who lived in that neighborhood. There are a lot of people like Cozy, like Miss Cozy, who have lived there for decades. They are homeowners. They are, you know, authentic middle class people like herself. A lot of people who are influential in the city and in politics live in that neighborhood. So there's a lot of history there. But to answer your question, maybe not. Maybe some people are aware of Hidden Valley across the state, but across the nation, maybe not. Probably not.
Up next, then, a similarly virtual Republican National Convention. Security precautions became more visible in Charlotte this week. That's a helicopter taking radiation readings over downtown, where the GOP will hold a one-day convention beginning Monday. Steve, what will this mean for Charlottesians, a one-day convention?
So it means that steel barricades started going up around the Westin in the convention center last night. There'll be some traffic tie-ups, but kind of the pomp and circumstance around this convention, there isn't much. I mean, this kind of looks like a regular old convention of, say, the American Legion. And it's interesting to me, I was over at the Westin last night, and when the delegates pull into that circular parking lot, the first thing, they are not greeted by any kind of ambassador bearing gifts. Novant Health has a purple tent, and there is a long line, desks of healthcare professionals. And even though every delegate has already taken one COVID test before they came, they are tested again immediately before even they check in, and they'll get the results back within hours or within a day.
And they're also being told to wear these contact badges that record who they come in contact with, I guess, so they can do tracing if they have an outbreak. CMPD starts security operations today. They won't give specifics, but they are erecting temporary fencing and changing traffic patterns. And here's CMPD Major Stephen Brochu.
The Center City is open for business as it is any other day. Certainly you'll see the security impacts as outlined through the maps with the fencing and things that'll go up on Sunday through Monday. But for all the people that live in Charlotte, you'll be able to get to and from your homes, no problem. You'll get to businesses that you want to attend to, and you'll just see some additional events that go on uptown.
So where exactly will these fences and traffic pattern changes be in place, and for how long?
It's basically just around the convention center. So streets like Stonewall, College, even the 277 ramp onto College, all those major streets right around the convention center will be closed. It's Sunday evening to Tuesday morning, I believe.
And they are also they're also shutting down the Lynx Blue Line at some point.
Correct.
So it does not go through the convention center with a bus bypass. Is that right?
Correct. And also, if you are trying to get that to that Whole Foods over there, you'll only be able to get in through the garage entrance off of South Boulevard, or you'll have to walk in.
And so, Mike, I was going to just say, if it's okay, just one more thing. You'd mentioned those badges that have this like Bluetooth tracking technology, mm-hmm. where they can the health people at the RNC will know who you've been in contact with. And it was interesting. I was talking to a couple of delegates yesterday who were, you know, like, okay, I'm good with wearing a mask. I get it. Social distancing, where you need to renominate the president. And I kind of mentioned this technology to them, and they hadn't heard about it. That was very next level. I mean, there was like a real, you know, like, you mean they have what? They're tracking where I go. It was just very funny to hear people being surprised by that.
I don't think they're tracking where they're going, but they're tracking other badges so that...
Yes, that's right. Who they've come in contact with. You're right.
Well, I don't know, Steve, because I did hear yesterday that, well, not their movements being tracked, but they're not allowed to venture out in the city that much, correct?
Well, no, they can go out for dinner.
They can go for dinner, but... Okay.
This is going to be considerably less hassle for locals than a full-fledged convention would have been. But why so much fuss for 336 people? As you said, Steve, this is like an American Legion convention. Would there be no security for that? Are any bigwigs coming to this that need to be protected by the Secret Service or others?
I mean, that I know of. I mean, I'm sure Ronna McDaniel will be here, the chair of the RNC, but no.
Marsha Lee Kelly. But, you know, bigwigs, not at this one, but maybe some bigwigs at the one down at the Dunhill Hotel.
Yes, that's the other Republican convention going on. That's the Never Trumper convention. It's going to go the full 4 days. And you're right. They may need some protection.
James Comey, Scaramucci. I just like saying his last name. Scaramucci is going to be there. So, you know, some pretty influential people are going to be right down the block. So this maybe they'll need more protection.
This is officially called the Convention on Founding Principles, which is being started by a lot of Republicans who feel disaffected by their current nominee and by where their party has headed. Their intent was to be here in tandem with the GOP convention so they'd get some media attention and perhaps present an opportunity for fellow Republicans to go, maybe I'll join you. What's the purpose now? Will anybody
notice?
Well,
I think they feel, what you said, Mike, is a really good point, because the whole key to being in Charlotte was you would have so many members of the worldwide media here for the regular RNC, and they could walk down the street and interview Never Trumpers. But I still feel they felt like it was still important to have some kind of physical presence here, even though a lot of the speakers are going to be remote. But they're going to kind of essentially it's a media opportunity to come speak to members of the party who aren't on board.
So I want to focus for a second, Steve, on city council, because there have been tensions rising among members of city council. It started with Dimple Ashmera and James Mitchell, two Democrats, taking issue with the fact that Republican Tariq Bakari's Carolina FinTech Hub was slated to receive about $1.5 million in a contract for training people. And they brought up the optics of that. So he didn't get that contract. And he was a little upset by that and insisted that there was nothing nefarious going on. Then the state GOP filed an ethics complaint against Dimple Ashmera and Smudgy Mitchell. And now the city attorney is investigating that, or he's having an investigator investigate that because he doesn't want to investigate his bosses, so he's hiring somebody to do it. And then there have been other ethics complaints filed, this time by citizens. What's going on here?
Well, I think there's kind of two issues. One is like you said, with Tariq Bakari's firm and the complaints against James Mitchell and Dimple Ashmera, some of those were detailed. I think there's some questions as to whether the decisions and everything was appropriate. And then at the same time, though, the city's ethics policy has this mechanism by which essentially every complaint has to be forwarded to an independent investigator. And that was done 5 years ago after Patrick Cannon was arrested in this kind of get tough movement on ethics. And so the city attorney feels that his hands are tied. So basically any complaint, there was a complaint made against Julie Isolt a couple days ago, mm-hmm. that will probably likely be forwarded. So you can have a situation where every council member can be under investigation if people want it that way. You know, if
Ed Driggs, the other Republican on council, one of two, had this to say.
I think it's been abused is the term I've used for it. The weaponized is an appropriate expression as well. So this is now becoming a means for council members to attack each other.
But that's not really what's happening. They're not filing the ethics complaints. It's other people filing the ethics complaints. It's the North Carolina Republican Party. It's individual citizens filing ethics complaints. It's not the council.
Yes, they're not filing them against each other. But I think probably what Ed Driggs was referring to is that, you know, people on a council member's team will, you can just get proxy. An ally or a supporter to file a complaint. But just having said that, I mean, there's some, Annie has done some really good reporting on this with FinTech Hub, and there's some key issues, important issues on this.
Well, speaking of ethics, this week, the State House of Representatives Rules Chairman David Lewis was charged by federal prosecutors with making false statements to a bank and failure to file a tax return. He then resigned his seat in the House. And he released a statement saying, this unfortunate incident is behind me. The agreement is the result of my failing to file my 2018 tax return on time and my including a false statement on a bank form. These are my mistakes and my mistakes alone. Mistakes? These are mistakes?
Yeah, he's accused, or he pleaded guilty at this point, but took $65,000 out of the account for his campaign and put it into something called NCGOP Incorporated, which was supposed to be a GOP, PAC or something of the rather. But it turns out it was something that he had control of and then failed to report it on his tax.
Reminiscent of what happened with, or the allegations against Steve Bannon, which resulted in his arrest yesterday. This came a day after sentences were handed down in the bribery case involving billionaire businessman Greg Lindbergh. He used former congressman and chair of the North Carolina GOP, Robin Hayes, as a go-between to give over $1.5 million to State Insurance Commissioner Mike Causey's 2020 campaign in exchange for Causey removing an official in his department. Causey chose not to cooperate with them, but rather with the FBI, and essentially turned them in. And Robin Hayes was found guilty of lying to the FBI. Later, he cooperated. The outcome was that he's gotten off. Essentially, probation, no real punishment except for a $9,500 fine. And Lindbergh, one of the state's GOP's largest contributors, was sentenced to 87 months in prison. That's around 7 years. And he has to pay a $35,000 fine. If you're a billionaire, that's like 35 cents to you or me. In a time when people are seeking social justice, is this justice?
And, you know, to add to that, Mike, David Lewis, I think he was sentenced to 0 to 6 months of prison time, and that's functionally going to be probation. So add that one to the list as well.
Okay. It was reported late last night or early this morning that former Panther coach Ron Rivera has been diagnosed with squamous cell carcinoma. The team says the cancer is in a lymph node and was detected from a self-care check. The team also says that the cancer is in an early stage and is considered very treatable and curable, providing a good prognosis for Coach Rivera for a full recovery. He, of course, is now the coach of the Washington football team, but he's a good guy. I know him personally. He's a wonderful person, so I wish him and his family well. I hope for a speedy recovery for him. Steve Harrison from WFAE News, Katie Peralta from the Charlotte Agenda, Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News One, and Annie Ma from the Charlotte Observer. Thank you all for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.